Next up, live from Washington, D.C., we're honored to have Sam Matheny here, Executive Vice President and Chief Technology Officer, the NAB. Give you some updates from D.C. and policy and some other good stuff. So go ahead, Sam.
Here, and I definitely want to offer Kent and Kyle and Michelle great kudos for putting this event together. I get to go to a lot of these, and this has really been a very well-run program. I also note that Cindy and Gary are former NAB Engineering Achievement Award winners, and I also, Harvey Arnold, want to offer some special congratulations to the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay Arnold Broadcast Center. I think it's truly fitting what Sinclair did to help support that. As I travel around the United States, one of the frequent refrains I hear is we need new blood in our engineering community, and setting up a program like that is a very real and tangible way of doing that. And speaking of new blood, Juan Galdamez of Xperi is here, and I believe he is going to earn the award for bringing the youngest attendee to the show. He has his son Finn at 11 months here attending the show. So yeah, thank you, Juan. Appreciate that. So I was asked to come and speak about a little bit of everything. And so I am prepared to do that. But before I do that, what I want to do is make sure that I'm speaking about what you all would find the most interesting or relevant. And then I'll kind of hop around through my presentation to look at any relevant slides. So if you will, how many of you all are radio engineers? Okay, and how many are television engineers? And how many are internet engineers? Okay. All right, well, we'll hit on a little bit of that. It looks like we've got a lot of radio and TV focus, and so one of the things that that we do at the NAB is we're really focused on three different pillars: advocacy, education, and innovation. Hopefully, being from the technology department, we're going to really bring that innovation. But what we also try to do is serve as the experts that inform our advocacy arms. So our legal group that it primarily works with the FCC on regulatory issues, as well as our government relations team, or GR, that really focuses on legislative issues and lobbying Congress. And so we try to be the experts that inform them so that they go and ask for the right things and seek the right solutions to keep broadcasting healthy. Our technology department, I've got a Zoom picture of the technology department, and you know, just looking at this picture really makes me glad that we're back and in person. I've been able, I think this is my fifth state association this year, and it's a lot of fun to be back and in person. But this is our vision statement. What we really want to do is improve lives through broadcast technology and broadcaster innovation. And broadcast technology are going to be things like all digital radio, like ATSC3. Broadcaster innovation is really going to extend into some of those internet applications, connected cars, and new forms of distributing our content that our members produce. So this is the team. We have specialists that focus on radio and television. We have others that focus really on a lot of the emerging technologies and internet stuff. And we operate a number of different committees. So what we really do is we convene a lot of folks. And so if you would be interested in participating in the Radio Technology Committee, the TV Technology Committee, or our Digital Officers Committee, Mike Kelly, who spoke earlier today, is the chair of our Cybersecurity Committee. So a lot of great ways that the NAB tries to bring folks together to share information and practices. So as I go forward, I'm really going to talk about some of our pilot projects ATSC3 and NextGen TV, the broadcast and broadband solutions, and some technology resources. But what I wanted to start with is probably a little bit more on the internet side of things, and I don't want to spend too much time on it because it didn't look like we had a whole lot of interest in this, but it is a very big issue. And it's one that we're exploring through a program that we call Pilot. Pilot is where we at the NAB fund a lot of the research that we do, a lot of the development projects that we do, and as the name implies, it's where we pilot a lot of things that ultimately get deployed in the industry. So third-party cookies, are you all familiar with what a third-party cookie is and what it's used for? Okay, it is a piece of code that is common in a lot of websites that identifies you and is shared with advertisers and agencies and others that did not directly collect that data. It is widely used on the internet, and it drives a lot of the programmatic advertising inventory. So third-party cookies drive a lot of revenue. Now, how much revenue do you think they drive? 100 million? 1 billion? 90 billion? Or $1 trillion in revenue? The answer is 90 billion. So $90 billion in revenue is derived from third-party cookies. And as that relates to publishers, McKinsey estimates that to be $10 billion. At NAB Show New York next week, you're going to hear, if you're able to be there, and if not, we're going to publish a report, but we have commissioned some research on this, that how much does it impact broadcasters. I'm going to give you a preview of that, and it's over $2 billion in revenue. So this is a really big issue that we are working on, honestly, with the support of Google, who is a member of our pilot program. So what they have done is they have funded both this research, as well as we have 30 broadcasters that are meeting on a regular basis and participating in an educational cohort that we are sponsoring. To explore how can we collect and use first-party data, data that we collect directly, because third-party data, due to a lot of the privacy rules, is going away. So Google, for example, controls two-thirds of the browser market, and they are going to turn off support for cookies. And that is why their people are trying to find solutions. So I would encourage you, if you have digital operations that derive revenue from the web, from mobile, from those sorts of applications that would use this third-party data, even if you don't know what it means, just come to nabpilot.org next week, and you'll be able to download the research report that Gordon Burrell has done on behalf of this project that we're doing. Another pilot project that we have is really for broadcasters, radio broadcasters, excuse me, and this is really about metadata in the digital dashboard. You know, cars and trucks today more and more often come with a screen. It's actually mandated. NHTSA several years ago said we're going to put a backup camera in every car to make sure that you know, folks are as safe as they can be, and they were really as a safety concern because so many small children were being run over. Well, if you're going to put a camera in every car, that means you're going to put a screen in every car. That screen has now become the home of a lot of different information in the way people interface with their vehicle. So, and that includes the radio. So instead of knobs and buttons, you're now really in a screen-driven environment. And this metadata best practices guide goes all the way from RDS to HD radio and also extends into connected radio, which is something that we'll talk about a little bit later. It is available on our website. The address is there. And it is really about trying to help broadcasters, radio broadcasters, have radio look as good as it sounds in the car. Right? It's always been focused on the audio quality, but now you have to be focused on what do you look like in the vehicle. Do you stack up against Sirius XM? Do you stack up against Pandora or Spotify or Apple Music? You can, and this guide will tell you how. Another project that we've been working on with the support of Xperi is Android Automotive. How many of you all are familiar with Android Auto, the application that lets you mirror your phone to the car screen? Okay, this is not that, right? This is Android Automotive. The brilliant marketing people at Google said, well, Android Auto is going to be this, it's going to be phone mirroring. Android Automotive is an entire operating system for the car, right? So just as if you go back to 2006, 2007, before the iPhone, before Android was, you know, powering half of the phones in the world, right? You know, Google sat down and said, we're going to write an operating system for the phone. And they released Android. Well, now Google has sat down and said, we're going to write an operating system for the car. And that's what's going, that's what Android Automotive is, right? And it is just barely beginning to roll out now. But ABI research says that by 2030, 36 million vehicles will be shipped with Android Automotive. And you can read the, you know, it's the big boys up there, right? It's Ford, it's GM, it's Volvo, it's Mitsubishi, it's Audi, right? Which is, you know, part of Volkswagen. So, like, it's going to be deployed in a lot of cars. So, and so you think about what the operating system is. I mean, it's going to impact your cruise control. Do your windows roll down? You know, does the air conditioner come on? But it's also going to control that infotainment system. And so what we've done through the pilot is we've created a program with the support of Xperi where we sat down to develop a framework to look at what does Android Automotive support and what do we need it to support in order for radio to really be able to maintain that premier placement in the cars of the future that are going to be running this. So what we did, again, with the support of Xperi, and they've been tremendous partners on this, is we created a global effort to do this. Because if you're talking to Ford, if you're talking to GM, if you're talking to Volkswagen, if you're talking to Google, they deal on a global scale. So it wasn't enough for just NAB to do it alone in the U.S. alone. So we work with broadcasters from all of these various countries, and you see the flags down on the bottom. And we developed a basically a line by line. We said, what do we need and do you have it? What do we need and do you have it? And then we developed a framework to address all of that, and we then presented that back to Google for their consideration. And what I would tell you is that as you look at the list of players up here, it's not just broadcasters. Ford participated, Volkswagen participated. So when we went in with the automakers, with the broadcasters, and with the folks that make the radio technology. And it's really been a unique and effective way of having a conversation with Google from three different sides all at one time. And what we really hope that's going to do is pay dividends, you know, in 2030 when Google, or excuse me, Android Automotive is widely deployed. So that's an example of a pilot project. I'm going to shift now and talk some about ATSC3. You know, we're in the deployment phase, but that really started in the U.S. in 2019. Been working on it for over 10 years or so up to that point, going through the planning stages, the requirements development, and actually completing the standard. It got deployed in the Republic of South Korea first, and then we're deploying here. Now it's being picked up by other countries as well. Jamaica has adopted it. Brazil has adopted many components within ATSC-3, and India has it firmly in their roadmap. So a lot of work going on here, but as it relates to the U.S., these are the statistics that we have again as of October 7th. So I put this together late last week. 287 channels on the air, emanating from 68 stations in 55 markets, reaching or serving, I should say, I'm not sure if it's reaching all of these, but serving markets that represent 51% of U.S. television households. And so that's a pretty good deployment. From an FCC perspective, if you think about the last transition, the transition from analog to digital, every TV station was given a second channel, right? Every TV station was told, you must do this. I don't care if you like it or not, right? This time, it is voluntary, and there is no separate channel that is being offered. So it is a much different type of transition. Now, with that being said, if we compare where we are 4 years into this transition versus where we were 4 years into the last transition, we are 86% ahead in terms of channels. We are 34% ahead in terms of markets, but we are using 56% less transmitters. That's because we're channel sharing. We don't have a second channel. Every broadcaster was not given a second channel. So using Washington, D.C., our home market as the example, Sinclair Broadcast Group told Howard University, why don't you put your PBS station, WHUT, on our 1.0 stick, and then you can become the 3.0 lighthouse. And this was done through a huge collaborative effort, but it included Fox, it included Sinclair, and it included Tegna and NBC. NAB played a role as it related to a fellowship that we set up. Pearl provided a lot of the maintenance, but basically you have that one ATSC-3 station, which is operated by WHUT. It's Howard University Station. That is the lighthouse, and it has five channels on it. It's got WHUT, and then it's got the Fox, CBS, NBC, and ABC affiliates. So that is how that is why we're able to launch more channels with fewer transmitters. Now, from my perspective, that's great because it gets us on the air, but it's really only step one, and we'll kind of walk through some of that here in just a little bit. So as we're talking about the transition and some of the tools, I want to focus a little bit now on ATSC-1. And this is a little bit forward-looking, but I say a little bit forward-looking only because some broadcasters are already starting to do this. So ATSC-1 uses MPEG-2. It's required by the FCC for your main channel. For your primary channel, you're required to use MPEG-2, and you're required to provide at least an SD quality picture. That's really what the regulations say. So MPEG-2, ATSC-1, streaming by and large was MPEG-4, right? So all your smart TV sets that have a Netflix app or a Amazon Prime app or a Hulu app, you know, or any of those things, they're primarily using MPEG-4. And then, of course, ATSC-3 uses HEVC as its codec. But one of the things that a lot of people may not know is that way back in 2014, ATSC, the Advanced Television Systems Committee, for ATSC-1 approved the use of MPEG-4 as part of the standard. And so why that's important today is it means that for your diginets, if you wanted to, squeeze more stuff in, you could use MPEG-4 as your compression. And you can see by the bar chart there, you're basically going, you know, to improve your capacity by about 50%. So this is how broadcasters are working today. And like, it's kind of crazy, right? Like, I've been in the business for about 30 years now, and to see fierce competitors collaborating in this way is wonderful. So when you're looking at your service lineup and you're trying to come up with that lighthouse, remember what I told you, this is how folks are doing it in a market. They're sort of moving around and moving their stations, and they're creating space so that they can launch ATSC3, right? So what we're saying is, if you wanted to continue that by using ABC, and you could take those diginets now, and you could continue to move those, and you can create more space for more ATSC3 stations. Why is that important? Because the more ATSC3 stations you get on the air, the more you're going to unlock the ability to actually do the cool stuff with it. Whether that's, hey, I want to do better, you know, audio and video, or I want to do more channels, or I want to do data services, whatever you want to do with it, the more you're channel sharing, the more you're constrained. And so what we're working on is coming up with methodologies by which you can do that. This is one. And so what I wanted to do was just flag some of the considerations. Again, as I said earlier, this would be for your diginets only. You need to think about over-the-air receivability. We've been working with the consumer electronics companies and the Consumer Technology Association for a while, really lobbying them, hey, you're already using AVC or MPEG-4 on your streaming services. Can you make sure you test that as part of your broadcast, you know, chain? Because a lot of them will say, yeah, if it works, it works. But if it doesn't, then, you know, we're not testing for it. So we've been lobbying them for a while. Hey, add this to your test protocol. More recently, we've been working to get all of that standardized through the ATSC so that all sets going forward will support this. But you do need to think about, there is a chance that every, you know, legacy receiver that's in the market may not be able to decode that. There's been some research done by different organizations that peg the number at somewhere around 85% of sets do support it. And so there's still a small number of sets that do not. But you'll want to think about that from a business perspective. You'll also want to think about those diginets. Do your affiliate agreements allow for it? A lot of diginets are over the air only, so you don't really have to think about cable. But if you do have cable carriage for your diginet, you're going to want to think about that too. But primarily only if they're actually receiving it over the air. You want to make sure that the IRD would be able to do that. So that's a potential consideration as well. All right, so let's look at the other side of this. Next Gen TV. You know, ATSC, again, Advanced Television Systems Committee, that is a transmission standard, right? It is not a receiver standard. What we have is the Next Gen TV, like ATSC 3, that's this horrible consumer-facing name, so it's really nerdy, and you know, you're lucky if you can spell it. And so we came up with Next Gen TV. The CTA, Consumer Technology Association, actually manages this logo, and they have the trademark on it. But this is the logo that they're putting on products. And this is these are their projections and forecasts for TV shipments. These are not third-party receivers, right? This is not a dongle or a set-top box or anything else. This is just a television set. And so you can see that we're about 4.5 million is what they're projecting for this year, growing to over 27 million in 2025. So that is a pretty good clip, but it's also one that we hope can be better, because if you're looking right now today, Sony is like the gold standard in my mind, because every TV set Sony sells in the United States is a Next Gen TV set. Not only that, when you plug it in and it does a channel scan, it picks the Next Gen TV stations first and it puts them, you know, front and center in your channel lineup, right? LG and Samsung are still forking their productions so that some are next gen and some are not. And then Hisense is another provider that has started creating some next gen TV sets. We still got more to go. If you think about like some of the store brands from Walmart or Best Buy, or even companies like Vizio, so we've got some work to do here. But these are the forecasts, and this is how the logo is being used. It's being used in store. It's being used in television commercials when stations are, you know, going on the air and beginning to promote that they have a next-gen service. It's being used at the points of sale. So this is obviously the logo circled in red there on a Sony Bravia box. And to get that logo, you have to pass a conformance test, right? So... and it's actually a suite of tests. As you can see, there's about 400 tests that we have in the repository right now. This is a repository that is officially maintained by CTA because they have the trademark on the logo, and they're telling their members, if you want to use this logo, you have to pass these tests. But we are jointly developing those tests. NAB is not only helping to say, here's what we think you need to test, we're also helping to fund the actual development of those tests. We have an interop program running right now, hosted by News, Press, and Gazette in Santa Barbara. We used to do these in person. We went to virtual with the pandemic. I'm hoping we're going to return to some of the in-person. But we actually work on these use cases and develop test signals that can then be used by the manufacturers. So this is a shot of our lab in Washington, D.C., and we were doing some work with NBC on their 4K Ultra HD feed of the Olympics here, but we have a full suite of ATSC3 equipment that we can run. We also have a radio test bed in this lab, but this is some of the work that we were doing as it related to the 4K and the HDR in that lab. Now, I want to talk now a little bit about broadcast and broadband as it relates to ATSC3, because this is one of the key components. And I was talking with somebody the other day, and their point was, if somebody launched a TV a channel with no audio, you would think it was broken. And they said that if you launch a next-gen TV channel without an interactive feature or application, then, you know, folks should think it's broken. This should be part and parcel of what it means to stand up a next-gen TV station. So if you're looking at this photo, this is a prototype application that we built a few years ago with CBS. And if you look right there, circled in the bottom, you know, corner, that is where the application is made available. So if all you want to do is sit back and watch TV, great, do it. Sit back, watch TV, enjoy yourself. But if you want to engage with this application, you can use your remote control to click on that menu. Now, that menu has several different items, and I'm just going to go ahead and bring them up. But in this example, what we did was we sat down with the producer of this segment called The Dish at CBS, as well as the business people at CBS, and we said, you know, what would you want to do? Well, this segment is all about cooking. It's all about Simon & Schuster and the cookbooks that they have, and it's all about recipes, because they feature a chef that's written a book and talk about the type of food that they have. They usually run a restaurant in New York. But in this example, we said, well, what you can do is you can increase engagement by offering VOD. You can increase engagement by offering the ability to socially share the recipe or information about the author with your social network. You can buy the book, which is a direct e-commerce capability, or you can actually pick which recipe you like, and you can order the ingredients, and they will be delivered to you via Amazon Fresh. Because remember, this application is running on a connected TV set. And this application is not, oh, I'm going to go and launch this separately like a Netflix app. it is a part of your channel. And again, that user can choose to sit back and not engage with it, or they can lean in and say, ooh, I want more info. I want to participate in this program in a new and a different way. Now, this is an app, I'm going to run through these quickly, that we did, again, prototype app with scripts that was focused on news and news literacy. And it was focused on how you might change your local newscast to take advantage of the connectivity that is offered by NextGen TV. All of those apps generate data. Right? Just like if you host a website, you get data. If you host a mobile app, you get data. And you can get first-party data from those applications. That first-party data is going to tell you how many people are watching your channel, and it's going to tell you how many people are interacting with your application. Right? So this is valuable information that can help you with your programming decisions as well as just your overall audience engagement. And so this is a platform, again, prototype that we've developed with our members that says, okay, how many people clicked on this particular piece of information? How many people were tuned in? And this is really going to be important, and it brings your television experience on par with what you're doing at on your websites and with your mobile applications. And by the way, those apps are written in the exact same language, so your existing programmers should be able to pick it up pretty quickly. This is a scalable video coding demo that we did at NAB Show. This is a combination of broadcast and broadband. Remember how I talked about everybody's channel sharing? Well, most people are channel sharing, and they're doing so using 1080p as their base layer. But we all know that one of the promises of NextGen TV is that it would enable you to broadcast, you know, 4K with HDR if you wanted to. You're not going to do that in a channel sharing environment because it uses a great deal of bandwidth. However, you can use scalable video coding, and you can take that 4K feed and you can run it through a scalable encoder, and you deliver part of it over the air. And in that over-the-air signal, the same way you can embed a link to your app, you can also embed a link that says, hey, you know what? I have an enhancement layer. And the TV on the other end will say, oh, I'm going to take that HD signal, 1080p, and I am going to combine it with the enhancement layer that's going to come in over broadband. And now, even though I'm in a channel sharing environment, I could deliver, you know, this really high bit rate 4K sort of imagery. We demonstrated this at NAB Show this past year. We worked with ATEM as the encoding company and with Samsung as the receiver company. So these are things where we do and push for a lot of this early work, and then we really lobby for it to be included in products that usually end up on the markets 2 to 3 years later. So this is another way that broadcast and broadband are combined. So I want to quickly run through some resources that are available to you. Hopefully this will be, hopefully it's not new information for you, but if it is, I'm glad, because that's part of why I'm here. One is the NextGen TV Transmitter ID Table, right? This is a tool that is uniquely identifies transmitters, full power and low power. They are tied to they're regionally unique. So because of the standard and the way it was written, there were only so many bits that we had to work with. So we created regionally unique IDs. We had the help of some of the experts that you heard from earlier, from Cabela Mertz, in doing this. And these IDs are regionally unique, and they are excellent for single frequency networks, which is another capability of NextGen TV or ATSC3, where you need the ability to uniquely identify every transmitter, even though the physical layer of what you're transmitting is meant to be identically the same. So if you go to this website, txid.nabpilot.org, you can hit a table that's going to look something like this. I get that this is probably an eye chart for you at this point. But what I did was I chose Madison, Wisconsin, and these are, you know, the stations that are there, and you can go and get, you know, your transmitter ID sets, and you can use those. And the reason this is important is because if you we need everybody using the exact same system for this. Otherwise, you know, different companies might develop their own transmitter IDs, and they might, you know, inadvertently use IDs that are the same as somebody else's IDs. And then the whole point of being able to identify your transmitter is lost. So we developed this resource in hopes that, that everybody will take advantage of it. There's no fee for it. We've developed it. We built it. Go to the website, and you can get your transmitter IDs. This is the ATSC 3.0 emissions checklist. This is sort of the partner, if you will, to the NextGen TV logo. This is an official ATSC document that is available through their website. It was developed by the conformance implementation team, and it lays out an emissions checklist for anybody launching an ATSC 3 station. And it's available for free there. This is a resource, the host station manual. So if you wanted to be that lighthouse, this is something that's put together by Pearl TV. You see the website there where you can go download this. They're on version 12. So this is a living document, even as they changed, it's not a SFN, even as they changed towers and frequencies, they handed off as this car drove and continued to download files to it. So some very real, you know, could that be navigation data? Could that be weather data? Could that be other information that, you know, a automotive system might need? All examples of what can be done. And again, Sony has published a paper about their ability to do this. So automotive is going to be a real opportunity, we believe, in the coming years for ATSC 3. With that, I want to spend a few minutes on connected cars and radio, and I'm going to borrow just a few slides from Xperi, so you'll see the format is going to change, and these are really about DTS AutoStage, and AutoStage is a connected car. Remember, we were talking about ATSC 3, we were talking about combining broadcast and broadband. This is a solution that does that in the car. Right? So what Xperi has done with AutoStage is they've developed a solution that combines radio broadcast over the air with internet connectivity. And they've done that to create a solution that is auto-centric. And I'm not trying to be a pitch for Xperi, but you know, you've got Android Automotive and you've got Apple CarPlay coming in, and they make every car look exactly the same. Whether, you know, you're talking about a super high-end Audi or Volvo, or, you know, a traditional type of vehicle like a Ford or a Mitsubishi. So if you're running from one spectrum to the other, they're making it look exactly the same. Xperi is partnering with them to say, hey, you know, you as an automaker can have your own systems. Not only are we having one screen in a car, but this is the Mercedes, I think it's the S-Class, but it has five screens in the vehicle, right? And so, and if you look at a lot of the newer cars, they're really, you know, almost becoming huge displays. And so, what AutoStage does is allows broadcasters to, you know, make sure that they're providing their data so that, again, that they look really good in these really screen-driven experiences. And I'm just going to hit on a couple of the features that are relevant, and that's just all of the different metadata that can be delivered, whether that is song, title, and artist, or your station logo, or they've even got solutions through partnerships with other companies that are advertising driven, that are creating new revenue for folks. Q is a company that has some of those solutions. So really, again, about making sure that when you're interfacing with all of these screens and you're competing with the likes of Xperi or Apple through their solution, or competing with the likes of SiriusXM, with Apple or these other really data-centric solutions, that radio can look as good or better than what they do. The other opportunity that it affords is something called, we call it service following, they are calling it station following, but the idea that you are tuned to the radio station, you're really enjoying it, the programming, and you don't want to leave it even though you're driving out of the area. You can choose to switch from the broadcast over to an internet connection to continue listening so that you can stay with your favorite station and the programming that you're listening to. Those are the types of opportunities that are available through a connected experience for radio broadcasters, and we believe Xperia's got a really good solution for it that is focused on broadcasters as opposed to, you know, some of the other solutions that are focused on themselves as a platform. So with that, I want to say thank you, and I really appreciate the opportunity of being here. I'm happy to take any and all questions and answer them to the best of my ability. And if you happen to be on Twitter, this is where you can follow me if you're so inclined. Thank you.
Do you know if there's been much, if any, testing done with legacy ATSC-1 receivers to see how they behave when they encounter a channel that's encoded in a codec other than MPEG-2?
Yeah, so the very first work that was done on that is, and so a lot of it has been anecdotal. Going back to, let's just say, 2016, Fox in their labs did some work, and where they were found about 60-70% of sets were able to receive and display an AVC or MPEG-4 signal. And more recently, a number of broadcast groups have done it, and they're finding that, you know, approximately 85% of sets are able to receive and decode an AVC signal. I do know that there are some broadcasters that are on the air, and they've made the decision to run their diginets in AVC today. So it is commercially viable if you're willing to take, you know, the risk of losing some percentage of your viewership. Anecdotally, there's a broadcaster in DC that did it, and they were using the "Does the GM's phone ring" as the measurement stick, and they said they got 3 phone calls, and so you know, and that's an anecdote, but that's the research as we know it today.
Sure, I guess my curiosity is more about legacy receivers that don't have AVC decoding hardware. I guess the thing in my mind is there are probably some old receivers out there that are going to crash.
Yes.
When you try to browse past.
So they're not. They don't crash. They just don't, you know, tune that channel. So what they'll do is they'll pick up your main channel, which will be an MPEG-2, because it has to be, but they won't see the AVC. I am not aware, have not heard of them crashing. They don't recognize it, so they don't deal with it.
Thank you.
Yes.
Vicky.
Hi, Sam. this is a difficult question, probably not fair to ask, but can you predict when the FCC requirement for ATSC-1 might end?
So there is no requirement. So there's no requirement that it must end. And there's actually no requirement that you even have to use ATSC-3. So as of now, using ATSC-3 is completely voluntary. The requirement that you probably want to be aware of is if you go to ATSC-3, there is a 5-year simulcast requirement. So I feel like maybe I'm answering a different question than you asked. I don't know.
That is helpful, but I'm wondering, when can we shut down our ATSC-1 transmitters?
I'm sorry. Say again.
When can we shut off our ATSC-1 transmitters? When's the end date?
Okay, so you have a 5-year simulcast requirement, that simulcast requirement was just being reviewed. So if you are on the air, I think the simulcast requirement will be up if it does not get extended. That's what we're working on at NAB. But there was a 5-year simulcast requirement from the time that ATSC-3 was approved for use. So basically, you're looking at about 3 more years, and then you could shut off your ATSC-1 if you wanted to. Does that answer your question?
Is the 5-year simulcast the substantially similar requirement between ATSC-1 and ATSC-3?
Yeah, but if you choose to go to ATSC-3, you can do that. Yeah, I mean, you can voluntarily choose to do it, but they're just saying you have to simulcast for those 5 years. And then at that point, you know, it's up to you as a business person to make the decision to say, okay, I'm comfortable enough that ATSC-3 is deployed enough that I'm willing to switch. Any other questions?
Thank you, Sam.
All right. Thank you.